Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello. This is Jim Stein, your host for New Books in Mathematics. Our guest today is Andrew Elliott, the author of Is That a Big Number? Is That a Big Number is a book for those of us who feast on numbers. We'll absolutely adore it, but we'll also tease the palates of those for whom numbers have been previously somewhat distasteful. This book helps us not only realize the relative magnitudes of many of the numbers which surround us, but also helps us understand precisely how and why our understanding of the universe often comes down to the numbers which describe it. It's just a shame that Pythagoras, who was reputed to say that all is number, isn't around to appreciate it. Andrew, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for inviting me, Jim.
It's a pleasure. You know, I like the quote from Philolaus with which you introduced the book. What are some of the different ways to think about big numbers?
Well, you know, Jim, when I was at school, we learned about numbers, starting from the very smallest numbers. And we become familiar with numbers that go into the tens and into the hundreds and sometimes into the thousands. But we really don't become comfortable with numbers that are much bigger than that. Now, of course, some people, I count myself among these, would have studied science and would learn scientific notation for numbers and learn to deal with very big numbers indeed. But when you use those kind of numbers, you're really dealing with them via algorithms, via techniques and tricks. And we don't, I think, have a feel for numbers once they get much beyond 1,000 or so. I think we all struggle with numbers along those lines. And so we need some sort of strategy for dealing with numbers as we go along. And in the book, I try to explain or group the strategies into five different particular techniques. And I'm sure we'll cover some of those as we talk through today.
I'm looking forward to it. You know, one of the things that's happening in the United States at the moment is we're having elections, and elections prompt conspiracy theories. And I was intrigued by the fact that your book sort of started off discussing conspiracy theories, and what would be a good example of how a numerical comparison could prompt a conspiracy theory?
Well, yes. As part of the project that this book forms part of, I started building up a database of numbers. And this went up into the thousands of number facts, as I call them. And it's no surprise that some of these start having some relationship to one another just by coincidence. It's no more significant than when Mars aligns with Jupiter in the night sky. But for example, to quote a rather silly but amusing one, I think, is that the height of the Empire State Building, if you measure it in terms of the standard square post-it notes, you'll find that it's exactly 5,000 post-it notes high. Now, I don't imagine anybody's going to build a conspiracy theory around that one, but there are other examples. For example, that the height of the Great Pyramid of Giza in Egypt is almost exactly 1/10,000,000th of the diameter of the sun. Now, when you've got so many numbers, it's bound to be the case that some of them tie up, and I think that there's plenty of it's not so difficult for conspiracy theorists to pull some numbers together and to start to try and make something of that. But really, comparisons, these coincidences are included in the book, really to help you to think about numbers it almost forms a triangle. You've got two numbers, two quantities, and a relationship between them, and that triangle helps you see the magnitude of the numbers involved. So a more serious example, for example, would be that the earliest stone axe from about 2.6 million years ago is about 500 times older than the oldest writing. So it's just that triangle of, on one point, you've got the 2.6 million years ago, 5,200 years ago, the first writing, and a relationship of 500 between them helps you establish a scale between those numbers in your mind.
You know, one of the things that I liked about your book is that you have a concept called landmark numbers. Perhaps you could explain those.
Yes. The analogy is with wandering in the countryside and knowing where you are by the fact that there are certain landmarks that you can see and recognize. And for myself, certainly, that there are certain numbers that I know. I've not sat down and studied these numbers or learned them, but for example, that you come across them and they lodge in your brain. So for example, the length of the equator, the circumference of the Earth, is just about 40,000 kilometers. Now that's a number that once you know that, you can start drawing comparisons. So for example, you might learn that Australia is 4,000 kilometers from east to west. Now that's a tenth of the equator. And Africa from north to south is 8,000, more or less, kilometers from north to south. And so these numbers help you form a realistic picture. And it's once these numbers start connecting with each other, you start forming, if I think of it as a scaffolding for the knowledge that you then acquire. And sometimes the number fits, and sometimes the number doesn't fit. And if it doesn't fit, you question it, and you see where something is wrong. If it fits, you add it to your scaffold, and you start building up a numerate world view that helps you in understanding the next numbers that then come along.
In talking about next numbers, how do estimation and comparison enable us to cope with numerical information?
Well, I think, if you build a mental model of the world, and the new information comes along, and it finds its place, or it's hard to assimilate. So, for example, I might tell you, or you might read somewhere, that, let's take an example, Morocco has a population of around 50 million people. Now, without context, that means very little. The 30 million people is a big number, and it's not easy for us to relate to that naturally. But if I tell you that that's about half as many people as there are in the United Kingdom, or it's about a tenth of the population of the United States, then suddenly you've got a reference point, you've got a comparison, and that helps you to assimilate that number and also to make it more memorable for you.
Yeah, I think that's right. And one of the things that you discuss, which was a concept that was introduced maybe 30 years ago, what is a numeracy and what isn't a numeracy?
Well, to my mind, the key concept here is whether or not you can relate the numbers to the real world. So I make the point in the book, it's very much not a book of mathematics. It's a book about numbers, and it's a book about numeracy, and that means connecting the abstractness of mathematics, if you like, the abstract concept of number, to the real world. And so that gives you a scale, it gives you a shape, it lets you understand the world that you're dealing with, but it allows you to judge the scale of the problems the world is facing. It's also, to tell you what numeracy is not, I don't think it's arithmetic. It's not being able to do hard sums very quickly. It's more understanding more or less how big things are, of being able to form a coherent picture of the world.
I think that's a nice way to put it. But when I was reading this, it occurred to me that numeracy and literacy are somehow related. And perhaps you could, perhaps you could expound on this.
That's one of my favorite topics, really.
Great.
We don't have circuitry in our brain. We've got, organic matter up there. This has not been crafted to deal with numbers. We've got very rudimentary numerical skills. But how have we been able to develop the massively technological culture that we have? And the answer to my mind, is that we've relied on skills to do with literacy. So there's a phrase that I use in the book, which is that counting is singing. When a small child learns to count, they learn a sequence of words that they repeat. And that's not so different from learning a nursery rhyme or learning the months of the year or the days of the week. They learn the sequence and then they carry out a matching procedure. And so the literate skill of learning words becomes part of the numerate skill of counting. And, you know, for example, I love it that sometimes we find that the words that we use conceal some hidden truths. So, for example, who is the person who will count up the money in the bank? It's the teller. And what does a storyteller do? Well, they recount the tales. So between the tellers and the counters and the tales and the tallies and the counts and the accounts, these are all entangled. These are all part of the same thing. It's all part of human culture, and numeracy and literacy work hand in glove to get to this point.
Well, you know, one of the things that stuck with me over the years is that there was an experiment performed long ago, well, maybe 30 or 40 years ago, in which people were asked to imagine that a stick was a billion long and to mark where a million lay on it. And a lot of them marked somewhere in the middle or something like that. And that's clearly a numeracy problem. And so one of the things that you did was you have numbers that are fairly large. And you talk about the idea of visualizing 1,000, a million, and a billion, and I'd like you to go into that.
Yeah, sure. So I take an example, and I ask the reader to imagine a tiny ant, just 4 millimeters long, sort of, much less than an inch. And that's just, we're going to have to we take such a small thing because we're going to get pretty big, and we need to start small. And then I ask you to imagine what would something that would be 1,000 times bigger than that. And I say it's a beetle. And what kind of a beetle is it? Of course, it's a Volkswagen beetle. It's a car which is just about 4 meters long. So you can paint a picture now. You can imagine the car, and you can imagine 1,000 ants lined up alongside it. So that's step one. So now I'm going to look for something that's 1,000 times longer than that Volkswagen Beetle. And wouldn't you know it, Central Park in New York City is just about right for our purposes. It's 4 kilometers long, 4,000 meters long, and it's laid out over 50 numbered streets, so we can even work out that calculation and see that there's 80 meters per city block, and you could put 20 of those Volkswagen Beetles on each city block, and you can imagine a traffic jam along Central Park West, 1,000 Beetles long. And if you've still got the ants in your mind, you might be imagining that there would be ants alongside those, and there'd be a million of them. So far, so good. So where do we go from here? What's 1,000 times bigger than Central Park? Well, I've already mentioned it in this chat. Australia, from east to west, is just about right. It's 4,000 kilometers from east to west. So if you can imagine the whole country of Australia, that would accommodate 1,000 central parks from coast to coast. And those 1,000 central parks, you can imagine a queue of a million Volkswagen Beetles lined up against them. And next to those cars, you would have to have a billion ants to make that chain across. So that's the scale we're dealing with here.
I think that's a nice way to look at it. But we have a million cars in Los Angeles on rush hour in a very short period of in very short space. So, as I know from commuting. Anyway, one of the things that you also talk about is the idea about thinking in two and three dimensions to help us visualize numbers.
Yes, I mean, this has almost become a mental tick for me in a funny way, that if I see a big number, so for example, if we're thinking in terms of somebody says there's, what did I come across, the number of a million, I will immediately in my mind convert that into 100 by 100 by 100 and imagine it as a cube, 100 in each dimension, because that brings the big number of a million back down into a comfort zone of 100 by 100 by 100. And it helps you to visualize it. It helps you to deal with the number. It helps you to, in a sense, tame that number so it becomes easier to think about.
Yeah, those are good ways to deal with it. And you also bring things down to the human scale when you talk about that there are some aspects of the human body we can use to help us visualize large numbers.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's fascinating that there's a lot in the book about, if you like, the history of measurement and what could be more natural than for the earliest measurements of distance and size to be based on the human body. So we've got the foot, obviously, but also people measure horses in hands. And we have the Bible referencing the cubit, which is the length of the forearm. And the word fathom, which is a fairly archaic word, most of us don't even know what a fathom means. But if you remember that it's, or if you know that it comes from the derivation of it, is arms outstretched, then it's easy to remember that it's 6 foot. And so from the earliest times, people have used the parts of the body as the basis of measuring distances. And of course, it goes beyond that, because when you start looking for bigger numbers, you start thinking about what you can do in a given time. So the Romans introduced the concept of a mile, 1,000 paces. And we have the distance of a furlong, which is a furrow's length. That's where the word comes from. And the old English measure of a league, which is 3 miles, which is as much as you can walk in an hour. So all of these numbers come from things that are very natural and very human, very much part of human life.
Yeah. One of the things that I enjoyed about reading your book, because I'm a number fan, is that there are a lot of gee whiz, fascinating numerical tidbits scattered throughout your book. Do you have any personal favorites?
Yeah, lots of them.
Okay, just a few. We want to get to other topics here.
I like, for example, that when I discovered that the diameter of the rings of Saturn, which is, that sort of iconic planet, is twice the diameter of Jupiter. And that's just a figure that, will stick in one's head. And that's about a fifth of the diameter of the sun. Here's another one. That the Las Vegas Strip is around 6.8 kilometers, and that's almost exactly 1/1000th of the length of the Nile River. Now, it doesn't mean anything that it's that length, but it will help. It helps one remember it.
It certainly makes me realize why they built the Luxor in the resort in Las Vegas at which I've stayed, which resembles Egypt and actually has a pyramid in it.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I'm sure they didn't have that in mind at the time. But yeah, it helps one remember. It helps one fix these things in mind. It helps one understand the shape of the world.
Well, because you feel that these ideas have helped you, would you advise that people find a few of their own that they can use as numerical benchmarks, or just look through your book and get some good ones?
Well, looking through the book is great, too. But
Nothing else, it gets them to buy the book.
Yeah, of course. But yes, I mean, when you see a number, you try and relate it to stuff that you know about, and sometimes you will find that it chimes with you, and that it makes a nice and memorable comparison there. And if you can hang on to that, then that can be the starting point for the next step, and the next step, and the next step, and slowly you build this network of numbers in your mind.
How does breaking a big number into smaller pieces help us come to grips with its size? Because what you've done is you've done sort of logarithmic comparisons so far, and also area and volume comparisons. But breaking a big number up into smaller ones is a different type of process.
Yeah. I actually, in the book, I describe a situation. We visited an ancient Greek amphitheater on the island of Sicily. And you go there and you think, how many people could this accommodate? How many people could be sitting here? And luckily, they've arranged it so that it's actually broken into 7 segments. So we can say, okay, we can make a first judgment on how many people could sit in one of these segments, and then multiply up, of course. But then we can count the number of rows. We can say there are probably around about 35 rows or something like that in each of these segments. Okay, how many people could sit on each row? In the front, they're going to be shorter rows. In the back, they're going to be longer rows. But we can work out an average. And then you've got 3 numbers to deal with. You've got how many people could sit in a row, how many rows are there, how many segments are there. And we come out at a number which is a bit over 5,000 people. But we've got there in easy steps. So you've got to the big number by easy steps.
Yeah, but it doesn't hurt to know the multiplication table.
Yeah, it's absolutely, absolutely right.
I have to say that my favorite portion of your book was the one where you discussed some of the key landmark numbers in the history of the universe, because I felt it was more than a nice summary. It was a nice summary of history, and I'd never seen history, which quite frankly bores me a lot, presented in that way, and I just loved it. Maybe you'd like to go through some of the numbers that are involved in the history of the universe and the history of Earth, of man's existence on Earth and recorded history, because I just loved that chapter.
Yeah, that's in some ways, these are some of the hardest numbers to get a grip on, because we can visualize distance quite easily, but time is a different matter in a funny way. And the history of the Earth it's a very long time. And the first one to realize is that compared to the age of the universe, which is about 13.5 billion years, the Earth has been around for about a third of that, which in some ways is surprisingly large. So for a third of the whole time that the universe has been around, the Earth has been around. But then it comes down to really thinking about the history of life on Earth. And you need to think that, while some simple life forms emerged relatively soon, but the big evolution of large-scale animals came with the Cambrian explosion. And that was only 500 million years ago. So there was 4 billion years of sort of building up to having visible life on Earth. And some other landmarks that you could think about there is that there was a mass extinction around 250 million years ago, and the vast majority of species on Earth disappeared. Now, this was before the dinosaurs. So the dinosaurs evolved after that mass extinction. And, of course, they themselves were victims of a mass extinction around 66 million years ago. And so to try and present and get an idea of the vast amounts of time involved here is really quite challenging. And I'm glad that you found something of use in that chapter.
Oh, I thought it was a lovely chapter. And one of the things that, sticking on this topic for a moment, there's a fairly well-known comparison in which what they do is they squish the history of the universe into a single day. And it's sort of interesting to note that the appearance of man is at about 11:59:59 p.m., 1 second before the clock strikes midnight. And that's, if I had a landmark number, that's the one that sticks with me.
That's quite right. And a counterpart to that, in a way, is the idea that the whole of human history, which is only about 5,000 years, is 1/1,000,000th of the lifetime of the Earth.
And these comparisons are, these comparisons are just wonderful, because they're the type of things, because they come from different areas of, different ways of comparing numbers, using area, using time, using length, that sort of ties numbers together with the reality that numbers are used to measure the quantities that mark our existence. And that's one of the features that I liked about your book, is that it wasn't arithmetic, it wasn't algebra, it was basically numbers. And I'd never seen a book like that, and I just loved it.
Good. Thank you.
And one of the things, you write a lot about, you put a lot, I won't say you put a lot of emphasis in, but a number of your examples deal with land areas. And what caught your attention when you were writing about land areas?
I suppose one of the things that struck me most forcefully was that the sizes of countries is such a skewed distribution. In other words, the very largest country in the world is Russia, 17 million square kilometers. And that's just about twice as big as the next. So then we get Canada, we get China, we get the United States. A little bit smaller than that, we get Brazil and Australia. But those big ones, those big six, really outrank most of the countries in the world for size. Then you get a tail starting with India and so on, it goes down. And it just seemed to be so strange in a way that, so for example, if your listeners have some statistics, they'll know the distinction between the median size of something and the mean size. So the median would be the one that sits in the middle, that there is many bigger than this than there are smaller. So Croatia as a country is very close to the median size. There is many countries bigger than Croatia as there are smaller. But Croatia is about one-tenth of the average size of countries. So if you're thinking what is a typical country in the world, it's a small country. And when I haven't really even thought through the implications of, so I'm still digesting this thought, as to what it means in terms of politics, in terms of global relations and so on, that actually the world is dominated by some big countries, and then that there are loads and loads of smaller countries forming a tail of the distribution. And that's not something that never particularly struck me before.
Well, not only had that never struck you, but as you were talking about this, it just struck me, for the audience, we're discussing this on the day after the United States elections. The yes. same not only applies to land areas in the United States, but also populations of states in the United States and the yes. areas of the states in the United States. And it's probably a very similar distribution.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And as a matter of fact, for those of us who like comparisons, that's sort of the idea of fractal, in that the same pattern is repeated on different levels.
Correct. That's true.
And for all we know, if we went into one of the states, we'd find the same about the counties. But that's actually not true. The counties are pretty much the same size. I don't know what it's like in England. Anyway, getting on to one of the next questions that I'd like to ask, which I'm glad that you sort of mentioned in the book, is that every so often there's a science fiction film about giant insects taking over the United States. There was a really scary one in the 1950s called Them. There was one in the 1990s. But why are the giant insects so beloved of science fiction, and why are they impossible?
Well, it comes down to what's been called the square cube law. So what this means is that if you take something of a certain shape, it could be a just a ball, or it could be an ant. And if you make that thing, if you multiply its length by a certain amount, then its surface area is going to go up by the square of that proportion, and the volume of it, and therefore the mass of it, is going to go up by the cube of that proportion. So I've seen the posters for that film, Them, and I'd say those ants are at least 4 meters long. They're as long as our Volkswagen Beetles. So if you multiply them by 1,000 in length, that means you've multiplied their surface area by a factor of a million, and they've multiplied their mass by a factor of a billion. Now, the strength of the limbs, those skinny little legs, the strength of that is going to be related to the surface area, both through the cross-sectional area of the limb. But the weight that it has to bear is related to the volume. And so if you scale up according to the cube square law, or the square cube law, I should say, that means that suddenly the weight is now 1,000 times too much for the limbs. And so those limbs would just snap, the skin would split, it would be an awfully messy scene indeed.
Well, I'm sure that many of our listeners are now going to sleep much easier at night. Anyway, one of the things that you discuss are the ideas of rates and ratios. And I teach math, and I often find students getting confused about those. But, of course, we just teach them as essentially tools, but you use them to compare numbers. And what are some good ways to compare using rates and ratios?
Well, these are most useful where you're dealing with two items or populations or countries or whatever that are that you want to compare, but they're of themselves of different sizes. So, for example, if you were to take the number of people, number of births in, let's say, the United States versus the United Kingdom, where I live, of course, there are going to be many more births in the United States because the population is five times the size than the United Kingdom. But if you divide the number of births by the population, you end up with a birth rate. And suddenly you've made things that were not comparable, you've made them comparable. And so now you find, in fact, the figures are very close to being the same in those two countries. And you've done that by standardizing them to a common basis. And really, that's a very useful way of involving big numbers. The other, of comparing big numbers. And the other one that is very natural to do is to talk about things like growth rates. So you take the value of whatever you're measuring at one point in time, and you compare it to what it was last year. So you might measure the growth in the economy or something along those lines, and you can calculate a growth rate. And in a sense, what you're looking for there is the relative change is what's important, rather than the absolute value of the thing. And you can compare growth rates across different countries and so on. It's a way of standardizing things in a way that allows you to compare them.
Another thing that I liked about your book is that you talk about some really large numbers and people, without using scientific notation, which generally bothers a lot of people. And I can still remember that my first introduction to billions came when a senator in the United States said, a billion here, a billion there, pretty soon you're talking about real money. Well, now we've got now we've got a national debt in the trillions. But when you talk about landmark numbers for mass, you get even larger than that. And so maybe you can discuss a few of those.
Yes. I'll take one example. So, for example, one of the things that we found out there is that if you take the volume of water in Lake Superior, for example, you find that that's 12,000 cubic kilometers. Now, that's a big number in itself. But each of those cubic kilometers is a billion cubic meters. It's a thousand by a thousand by a thousand. And each of those cubic meters of water would weigh approximately a ton. So if we were to calculate out the total mass of the water in Lake Superior, we're getting to 12 quadrillion kilograms.
Go ahead. I was just going
to
say
that's 10 to the power of 15 to revert to the scientific notation.
But the great thing about that is that what you've done is if you say quadrillion to somebody, it's basically meaningless. But when you say that's the mass of all the water in Lake Superior, 10 quadrillion, now you've related a large number to something they can deal with. And I think that's an important part in fostering numeracy.
Absolutely right.
Then in the next chapter, you go on to a topic which you've termed very nicely. What is number spotting and what does it have to do with Benford's law, which I've always considered fascinating?
It is fascinating. Number spotting is actually the name I gave in my head to a game that I used to play when I was a child. Growing up on long, boring car journeys, I would look at the number plates of these cars and I would try and spot successive numbers. So you'd start off by saying, can I spot a number starting with one? Then can I see one starting with two, three, four? And so it goes. Once you get to nine, you're looking for a number that starts 1, 0, then 1, 1, then 1, 2. So it gets harder and harder to play this game, and it's more of a challenge and it's more rewarding. When you spot 323, then you really, it feels like an achievement.
It took a while, didn't it?
Exactly. But the interesting thing is, of course, it's harder to spot 1, 0 than it is to spot 1, but it's actually harder to spot 9 than it is to spot 1. And that's because numbers tend to start from 1. And so you can't, if you're allocating numbers sequentially, you can't have a 9 without there being a 1. And you can't have a 2-digit 9, which you'll hit at 19 and then 90, without there being loads of numbers starting with 1 that have come before. So this was my game as a kid. But then I discovered that this is actually an example of what's called Benford's Law. And that means that it says that if you take a collection of numbers, and you can, these can come from interesting and different places, like company accounts, like voting records and so on, you'll find, and this is quite strange, that around 30% of those numbers will have a leading digit, which is 1. And less and less, until you've got only 4% of those numbers, will start with 9. And in some ways, this seems quite strange, because you'd expect them somehow to be even, but they're not. And people have actually used this Benford's Law as a means of detecting fraud. If somebody is cooking the books and making up numbers to go into falsified company accounts, and if they're not aware of Benford's Law, they may well, say, have numbers starting with 7, which seems to be a popular one, much more frequently than would occur by chance. And auditors have actually used this law to pick up suspicious accounting in audits. So yes, it's a strange thing. Now for this book and for the Is That a Big Number project, I collected a huge database of numbers facts. And I tried to see if this would apply to these numbers. Now, these numbers come from everywhere. It's the height of the Eiffel Tower. It's the water in Lake Superior. It's the the size of a playing card. They are from all different kinds of domain. And lo and behold, they fit Benford's Law pretty well, pretty well.
You know, you just mentioned something, which I'm not sure whether it's mentioned in the book, but you discussed something in the last few moments called the Is That a Big Number Project. Is that an actual project, or is it just something you did? Is there a database with these numbers in? I don't want to I don't want to dissuade people from just looking at the database, not reading the book, because the book itself is fascinating. But I'm sure that if there were a database like this, it would be a wonderful complement to the book.
Yes, there's a website called isthatabignumber.com.
That's exactly the question that I wanted answered. I may look at it after this interview.
And it's got some fun things on it, and it's my source for a lot of the numbers in the book.
Good enough. How are logarithmic scales used to compare numbers?
Well, the thing about logarithmic scales, and some people get frightened by logarithms at school, but I think they're like a little, like a superpower of understanding numbers. So if you have a situation where you've got some very small numbers and some very large numbers, and you try and compare them in the normal way, it's very difficult because you can't say much about it other than that some are very small and some are very large. So an example would have been when a gentleman called Charles Richter was analyzing earthquakes. He knew that there were hundreds of earthquakes happening every day on a very small scale. But occasionally there would be something that was much, much bigger, millions of times bigger. And he realized that it wouldn't be very hard to put together a sensible way of measuring these things until he came up with the idea, actually it was a colleague of his who came up with the idea of using a logarithmic scale. And what that means is you're counting the powers of 10 involved. And so the Richter scale for measuring earthquakes, if you add 1 point to the scale, 1 point to the magnitude, it means you're 10 times larger. So if you go to 4 to 5, it's 10 times larger. 5 to 6, it's 10 times larger again. So 100 times larger in total. And so it brings these numbers down to a manageable level. It tames this exponential growth that you see in certain things, and it brings that down to a scale where they become easier to relate to.
I think at this stage I have to mention a classic in that area, the video or movie called Powers of 10 by the Ames Brothers. You know that one?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, it's a lovely way to visualize the logarithmic scales, because it goes from the tiniest things in the universe to the biggest things in the universe.
Exactly.
And speaking of biggest things in the universe, could you describe the landmark numbers you use, which each differ by roughly two orders of magnitude, which is a power of 100, to go from the size of the universe to the size of the solar system? Because I found that a nice stepping stone bridge.
Yes. So if you're thinking about distance, obviously the biggest distance you can imagine would be the diameter of the observable universe. Now, I'm going to come back the other way.
You can start at either end.
Okay, let me see where I want to go for. So if you start with the solar system,
It's probably more natural to go up than down, so go ahead.
We know that the Earth and all the planets orbiting the sun occupy only actually a very small proportion of this whole solar system. So to get to the point where the sun's gravity is no longer the dominant gravity, we could journey out from the sun about 2 light years. So we'll start from that point. So if you think of the solar system as being a sphere about 4 light years across, that's our starting point.
Okay.
But the sun sits within a structure that astronomers have called the local bubble within our galaxy, and that's about 300 light years across. So it's about two orders of magnitude bigger. So when we get to these kinds of numbers, we're not terribly concerned about whether it's 10% bigger or 10% smaller. We really are concerned about the orders of magnitude here. So our local bubble is about two orders of magnitude bigger than the solar system. Now the galaxy, the Milky Way, is around 120,000 light years across, and that's about 2.5 orders of magnitude bigger than the local bubble. So we're going in steps that are, roughly speaking, 100, a bit more than 100 now to the size of the galaxy. Now, the galaxy, along with Andromeda and Triangulum and a couple of other things, is part of a local group of galaxies, and that's about 10 million light years across. And that's another hundredfold step, another two orders of magnitude bigger than the galaxy. And that sits within what's been called a supercluster. And ours has been called La Niakea. And that's a supercluster of galaxies about 520 million light years across, almost another two orders of magnitude. And then to get from there to the observable size of the universe, it's around another two orders of magnitude. So hopefully what that does is it can cement in your brain, as it has in mine, a series of steps that you can take, increasing in scale each step along the way, that helps you. I mean, these are unimaginably big numbers, and we need to think of techniques. We need to think of tricks to help us to think about these things and keep them, establish a scale between them. It doesn't make them any smaller to think about it this way, but perhaps by breaking into steps, it becomes a little less overwhelming, less of a sheer mystery, and more something that you can actually think about.
I'd like to jump ahead because we're getting a little, we got to some big numbers. So let's get to the really, really, really big ones. The ones that basically enter into the idea of what arithmetic and the number system is. And this is connected to computation. And, how do we measure the difficulty of computing something?
Yeah. People design algorithms, when people are working with understanding how computation can happen, it's very important to understand the scale of the problem and, in the terms of the jargon, how the problem scales. In other words, as the problem gets bigger, does the effort required to solve the problem get bigger by about the same amount, or does it get bigger a lot faster? Now, there's a classic problem in this area called the traveling salesman's problem, which is, ask you to imagine that there's a traveling salesman and he needs to arrange a journey to visit a number of cities to make his sales visits. And the question is, what is the most economic way of him to organize his trips to these cities? He's going to make one round trip, but which is the quickest way of doing it? Now, this is a problem that seems very trivial in the way I've stated it. it's a very easy problem to understand. And you can understand that if he's got a home location, he's got two cities to visit, then there's really only one trip he can make. He can do it either way, but there's only one possible trip that is sensible. But if he's got five other cities to visit, then suddenly he's got to make, there are 60 possible routes to evaluate. If there are 10 other cities to visit, there's 1.8 million to visit. And if it goes to 30 other cities to visit, we get to the unimaginably big number of 132 non-million. There's a word for you.
Yeah, that word. Haven't seen that one much.
10 to the 30. So the point here is not that we are really trying to make things easier for traveling salesmen, but these are problems that have to do with there are lots of problems which are essentially the same as this problem. So it might be to do with programming machines to drill computer circuit boards. It may be anything that that is trying to optimize the order in which you are visiting and performing various tasks. And in all of these situations, once the problem gets to even relatively modest numbers in the problem, the solution becomes really, really very hard and beyond the scope of even the fastest computers to compute. And so this is, these are serious challenges for people working in algorithm design and so on, is to bring down the order of complexity of these problems. And the problem is really just that the numbers get so big.
And speaking of numbers getting so big, what is Graham's number?
Graham's number, I first came across this I had a copy of the Guinness Book of World Records from 1980. And it told me that it was the most massive finite number ever used in a serious mathematical proof. Well, since then, there are bigger numbers. But Graham's number at that time was the biggest number that had ever been seriously put forward in a mathematical proof. Now, this number involves raising, taking powers of numbers an unimaginably large number of times. And it's very hard to even describe the recipe for calculating this number. It would be completely impossible to actually calculate it. The universe wouldn't have time nor materials to accommodate it. So I ask the question, is this even a number at all? And my answer to that is yes, it is, because even though it's just an algorithm that we understand that could be used to generate the numbers, if I write down 323 on a piece of paper, I've not written down a number. I've written down a series of symbols that will allow somebody else to recreate that number. It's just the same way. It's an algorithm that I've written down, and that is a recipe for creating the actual number. And no less is Graham's number a real number, even though we could not possibly write it down in digits.
One of the things that made a large impact on me in my youth was when I saw the movie 2001: A Space Odyssey. I don't know whether or not you've seen it, but it was a classic.
Of course.
Okay, I think everybody has. And there's a scene at the very towards the end of the movie where the spaceship has gone out to Jupiter, and there is a caption which says "Jupiter and beyond the infinite." It's a good place to wrap up this interview by asking you where you stand on infinity being a big number.
Well, yes. I remember as a child, we used to joke and we used to talk about a number of, we call it uncountable. And that was our schoolboy version of infinity. But in fact, the great mathematician Cantor, he got to grips with this concept of infinity. And he used exactly the same sort of matching logic that we would use for counting, you know, the apples in a bowl. And that is to say, if you can match two sets together, one for one, then they must have the same number. And so he was able to start categorizing different kinds of infinity and making sense of that whole concept. And so he defined what we call transfinite numbers. And those are what we would loosely call infinity. But of course, infinity has no point on our number line. Infinity is more of an end point of a process than it is of a particular number. So Is it a big number in the sense of the book that I've written? No, it's not. It's in its own world. It's in its own collection of numbers. It's the transfinite numbers. And in fact, the number of all of the counting numbers is the smallest of those transfinite numbers. It's the smallest infinity. So I would say that it's in a different domain of its own.
Well, we expect your next book to be Is Infinity a Big Number? And speaking of next books, do you have any projects that you'd like to tell us about and that I might be able to talk to you about sometime in the future?
Well, there seems to be a natural companion book to this one, which would be Is That a Small Number? Because there's an awful lot of interest in things that are of microscopic scale or nanoscale. But more than that, one of the things that I consciously left out of this book, and it is an area, I think, where people struggle in a numeracy sense, is the understanding of risk. And risk tends to be small numbers. It's, you know, the chance of winning the lottery. It's the chance of dying from, you know, some freak event and so on. People have difficulty in understanding risk and understanding small proportions. So I haven't yet got a shape for this book, but I think there might be something there along the lines of Is That a Small Number? And that's one of the things I'd want to tackle, and that is talking about how we understand risk.
You know, it's funny because when you said, is that a small number, the first thing that leapt to my mind was Richard Feynman's quote when he gave a lecture at Caltech, I think it was in 1958, describing the possibility of what you might call nanophysics, doing physics at the small scale. And yep. He said, there's plenty of room at the bottom. That was the title of his lecture.
Yes.
And I was thinking you were going in that direction. And for all I know, maybe I've prompted a line of thought in you.
Absolutely.
Anyway, also the last thing that I would like to ask you is if one of our listeners or hopefully lots of our listeners would like to get in touch with you, how do they do that?
Okay, well, there's a website, isthatabignumber.com. And there are links there to follow a Twitter feed. They may be interested in that. But equally, there's a website, www.andrewcaelliott.com, which is my personal website, and there'll be a contact form on that website. So anybody wants to get in touch, they can use that contact form, and I'll get right back to them.
Terrific. Andrew, it's been a pleasure. Take care.
Thank you very much, Jim.